60 minutes, and he and the others would be on the chopper, heading back to base. It would feel like an eternity. Unable to sleep, Roland spent the quiet hours trying to order his thoughts. There would be much to report upon their return, particularly about the strange weapons which had killed Byrne and Pearson. Were the Russians supplying some kind of new technology to the Kong? That didn't explain the dead Vietnamese soldiers, but the thing had come from somewhere. Who was responsible? The spooks can figure it out. Two short low hisses from behind him made him pause in mid-step. The muted warning from John Coffrin told him that the other Marine had heard or seen something. With agonizing slowness, Roland placed his foot back to the ground before lowering himself into a crouch. Once there, he shifted just enough to see Coffrin. The Lance Corporal squatted 5 meters behind him, the barrel of his shotgun resting across his left forearm. Behind him, and separated by a similar interval, Bill Eisner had dropped to one knee, his M16 up and ready. Coffrin, his gaze focused on Roland, pointed toward his own eyes, then gestured toward the jungle ahead of them. Enemy spotted. Turning to look in the indicated direction, Roland scanned the jungle, searching for movement or anything which looked out of place, some shadow or shape that seemed not to belong. Though his eyes and ears told him nothing was there, every muscle and nerve ending signaled danger. Despite his best efforts, Roland felt his breathing quicken in anticipation, and his pulse now pounded in his ears. Staring into the gloom, he felt his right hand tightening around his M16's pistol grip. Something's wrong, damn it! The crack of a tree limb, perhaps 30 or 40 meters away, was like a rifle shot ripping apart the silence around them. Roland jerked his head around to look for the source, catching sight of something moving among the high branches of a tall tree. A dark silhouette scrambled as though trying to keep from falling. Without thinking, Roland lifted his M16 and sighted down its barrel. He was too late. Someone else fired first. AK-47 fire from multiple points among the dense undergrowth tore apart the night air. Roland flattened himself on the ground, glancing behind him to see that Coffrin and Leisner were following suit. Ahead of them, the gunfire continued, though now it was accompanied by something else. Hear that? It was Coffrin, his voice low. He pointed his shotgun toward the chaos. It's the thing that killed Pearson. I'm sure of it. Roland realized his friend was right. Flashes of green light, like tracer fire, but larger and slower, were raining down from the trees. Each time one of the pulsing orbs struck, they detonated like dynamite, and Roland saw a figure silhouetted by the blast. Ambush! Said Leisner, who had crawled closer to his companions. Jesus, we almost walked right into it. Rifle fire concentrated on the tree that was the source of the odd light, and Roland saw the other, larger figure moving with speed and agility among the branches. Who the hell could move like that? Shouts from somewhere else in the nearby bush, anxious voices yelling in Vietnamese, were accompanied by shots. This time, the rounds were coming in their direction, and Roland and the others flattened themselves on the ground. I think they know we're here, said Leisner. Exchanging his rifle for the M79 slung across the top of his rucksack, Roland breached the weapon and exchanged the buckshot round for one of the high-explosive shells from the bandolier he'd taken off Scotty Pearson. Leisner was already firing his M16 into the brush, and Coffrin added 4 shots from his Remington shotgun. Raising his head, Roland caught sight of 2 enemy soldiers crouching behind a fallen tree. "Fire in the hole!" He aimed the M79 and pulled the trigger. A second later, the grenade struck the tree in front of the enemy soldiers and detonated. Roland saw both men fall back and out of sight. For the first time, he realized that all of the other shooting seemed to have stopped.
How many?
He asked, dropping to a knee. Coffrin, bracing his left shoulder against a thick tree, fed new shells into his shotgun.
10 or 12 at the start. No idea now.
Over there, shouted Leisner, elevating his M16's muzzle as though sighting on a target well above the ground. Roland trapped the other man's aim in time to see the dark figure scrambling among the high branches. The thing was huge,
far larger than a man, and crossing gaps between trees that were too far for any normal person to negotiate. Its size and agility were matched only by its speed, which was almost too fast to follow. Cochran unloaded his shotgun while Leisner emptied another magazine from his M16. None of the rounds seemed to find their mark, as the shadowy figure lunged from branch to branch. Reloading the M79 with the buckshot round, Roland shifted his aim just as the thing stopped less than 10 meters away, and he saw something on its left shoulder pivoting as though aiming in their direction. "Look out!" The warning came too late, as a blob of green energy spat forth from the odd device, striking Leisner and driving him backward. Roland saw the bolt drill through the corporal's chest and chew into the damp, muddy ground behind him. Already dead, Leisner fell in a limp heap, his jungle hat falling from his head and revealing his open, unseeing eyes. "No!" Roland aimed the M79. Before he fired, he had time to note the figure's bizarre appearance. A helmet that covered its face, and clothing that looked more like mesh covering a massive, muscled body. A belt and harness carried numerous items, none of which Roland recognized. "What the hell is it?" He pulled the trigger and the thing started to move, but the grenade was faster. The expanding cloud of buckshot hit it full in the chest, knocking it from its perch and sending it crashing toward the ground. Out of buckshot, Roland loaded the launcher with one of his remaining high-explosive rounds. He aimed the weapon where the thing had fallen. Was it still alive? Where had it come from? He started to advance, but stopped when he felt Cochran's hand on his shoulder. "Listen," his friend hissed, and pointed toward the sky. "Choppers!" The pain was severe, yet manageable. Nakmechi rolled onto his side, every movement a small agony as he took stock of his condition. The swarm of projectiles had inflicted several wounds across his torso and extremities. His biomask remained functional, allowing him to see the two remaining humans plunging deeper into the jungle. Judging by their movements, they were discarding stealth in exchange for speed while seeking escape. In the distance, Nakmechi heard the familiar sound of human air vehicles, drawing closer with each passing moment. He cursed his carelessness. Spotted by one of the soldiers lying in wait to ambush their adversaries, he was left with no choice but to neutralize the humans. What he had failed to anticipate was a tree branch that was insufficient to support his weight. Its breaking had drawn the attention of the entire party, and without his cloaking shroud, Nakmechi was forced to protect himself. He had taken most of the ambush force, with the others killed by their adversaries. That his kills were born of necessity rather than sport was disappointing. There were the three last remaining humans, but his chance to take them was fading. They, at least, might provide one last challenge, but was he up to the task? A drug from his medikit provided a powerful stimulant and helped keep his pain at bay. But healing his wounds required the resources aboard his ship. Returning there would likely mean giving up this final chance to take trophies. For a blooded hunter of any worth, there was only one choice. Pulling the incendiary grenade's pin, Roland threw it toward the center of the glade. The grenade disappeared into the tall elephant grass and began spewing yellow smoke, the color designated as the signal for their extraction. Within seconds, the cloud of smoke expanded and rose toward the sky. "Here they come," said Cochran from where he crouched next to Roland in the tree line south of the clearing. Roland felt the first rush of relief begin to wash over him, as he watched the first Bell UH-1 helicopter appear over the nearby trees and make a circuit of the area, flying low and fast. Its side door was open, and a gunner sat behind an M60 machine gun, aiming the weapon toward the ground as he searched for threats. If anything looked as though it might present a danger to the choppers, Roland knew the gunner would unleash the M60's fury upon the jungle below them. "Get ready." Wearing the M79 slung across his chest while he gripped his M16, Roland divided his attention between the trees behind them and the second Huey as it maneuvered into view. Unlike his companion, who had assumed an orbit above the landing zone to provide security, this chopper was making a rapid descent toward the clearing. Roland waited until the Huey was less than 20 feet above the ground to slap Coughran's back.
Go!
Both men sprinted from the tree line and into the open. Roland counted the seconds as the chopper dropped to hover mere feet above the ground. The action of its rotor blades flattened the grass, providing a clear approach for the two Marines as they closed the distance. All other sounds were drowned out by the Huey's engine, which the pilot was already revving in anticipation of takeoff. Then Roland saw the bolt of green energy punch through Coughran, never hearing the bark of the strange weapon that killed him.
John!
Coughran, already dead, was falling to the ground as the Huey's gunner swung the barrel of his M60 to return fire, and Roland had to drop as a hellish torrent of bullets spat from the weapon towards something he couldn't see. Rolling away from Coughran's body, Roland twisted around and came up on one knee, aiming his M16 back toward the tree line, just as another green fireball streaked across the clearing. The shot was off, but still close enough to graze Roland's left shoulder. Molten heat exploded at the point of impact as he spun and dropped to the grass. The M16 fell from his hand and he landed hard on the grenade launcher that was still slung across his chest, gasping as he felt what had to be a rib crack. He looked to the edge of the clearing in time to see the mysterious figure. The thing, emerging from the undergrowth 40 or so meters away. Even from this distance, Roland saw yellowish-green fluid draining from multiple wounds in its chest and arms. Whatever it certainly wasn't human. It was like a nightmare come to life. The odd weapon mounted to the thing's shoulder swiveled to aim toward the sky. There was no time or chance for Roland to offer any warning before the weapon fired a stream of hellish-green energy skyward. 3 of the shots struck the chopper, including one that hit its engine compartment, and the Huey exploded in midair, ripping itself apart as it lost all flight and plummeted in a flaming heap to the ground. It disappeared into the trees north of the LZ, where a second detonation released a roiling cloud of fire and smoke. Behind him, Roland could just hear the remaining Huey's gunner, shouting above the roar of the engine, "Come on, man! We've gotta go!" Without air cover, the chopper was in greater danger of attack by ambush from the trees. Its pilot would want to get the hell out of here, and Roland knew if he didn't move, he risked being abandoned. Then the creature charged. Not as fast as Roland had seen it move earlier. The thing was still able to dodge the Huey gunner's renewed string of M60 fire. It released a guttural roar that Roland heard even over the chopper's engine, weaving and dodging the machine gun's bullets with uncanny speed. Roland ignored the gunner's shouts to get aboard, along with the pain from his shoulder and his injured rib. Every breath was like someone stabbing him in the side. Gritting his teeth, he lifted the M79. Without thinking or even really aiming, he pointed the grenade launcher at the creature and fired. The round landed short, perhaps 3 meters in front of the thing. But when it detonated, the blast was enough to knock the creature off its feet. Muscled arms and legs flailed as the thing dropped to the ground, hidden by the elephant grass. The Huey gunner raked that area with the M60 as Roland turned and ran for the chopper's open door. He stopped short as the other man was thrown backward by another of the green bolts, his body sailing through the open door on the helicopter's far side. In the cockpit, the pilot's expression turned to one of horror, before the entire side of the canopy disappeared in a burst of fire and glass that was whirled about by the action of the Huey's rotor blades, and Roland fell to the grass to avoid being struck by shrapnel. A 3rd round from the bizarre weapon ripped through the chopper's cockpit, killing its co-pilot while Roland could do nothing but watch. A shadow fell across the grass in front of him, and Roland rolled over to see the creature standing above him. The thing was massive, its hands terminating with oversized claws which were not at all human. Its left arm hung limply at its side, and the same pale yellow-green fluid ran from dozens of wounds across its body. Even the strange helmet it wore to shield its face was marred, likely peppered with shrapnel from the grenade. Its breathing sounded as though it might be labored. And while it looked capable of killing him with little effort, Roland sensed no real malice from the creature. It was studying him, as though he were nothing more than a lab specimen, or even an insect.
What the hell are you?
Nukmechi was dying. His wounds from the explosive, coupled with the injuries already sustained, would prove fatal if left untreated. That much he had learned from his ship's automated medical equipment. Honor precluded him from using those same facilities to heal his failing body. While he had successfully completed his mission, the records of which would be returned to the homeworld with or without his being alive to accompany them, he had failed to carry out the hunt. One might argue that the exercise was unsanctioned, and therefore not subject to the rules and codes observed by all-blooded Yautja. Nukmechi chose not to exploit such a faithless interpretation of the rituals which had defined his people for uncounted generations. He had failed. Therefore, his life was forfeit. Sitting at the controls of his ship, Nukmechi studied the flow of information being relayed to him through the vessel's network of scanners and recording devices. From orbit high above the lush blue-green world, he was able to watch the land battle currently underway in the section of continent he had left behind. If the data from the scans was accurate, the invading or occupying force, with its superior weapons and equipment, was currently enduring simultaneous armed incursions at numerous locations across the region. The attacking force, which seemed to call this land home, had launched a massive, multi-pronged offensive. It was a bold strategy. Its scope rivaled only by its audacity and synchronicity. Nukmechi suspected the targets of this attack would retaliate, bringing to bear all of their supposedly greater weapons and technology. The question was whether their spirit would be broken by this assault, or fueled by a need for vengeance. Regardless, it would be something to behold, though he would not live to see it. He cared not at all about which side might be the victor. It was the thrill of the conflict which drove him, as it did all true hunters. All that remained for him was to verify that his ship would follow its programmed course home, and that the report of his mission was safeguarded until it could be studied. He was confident his findings would be greeted with much enthusiasm by those eager to partake of a new challenge here on this world, which already had afforded so much in that regard. This much was embodied by the skull sitting before him on the console. Despite his injuries, Nukmechi had taken the time to ensure it was cleaned and polished, ready for display along with the rest of his collection. His prey deserved such respect, for this was a proper trophy, taken from the remaining human who had proven a worthy adversary. If Nukmechi harbored any regrets, it was that he would never again partake of such rewarding contests. This prize, along with his report, would provide his clan with all the assurance and encouragement they needed to return to this world and relish in the sport it continued to offer. Hunting here remains fruitful.
Game World by Jonathan Mayberry. Chapter 1.
Who's ready to die?
The words blasted out of the speakers, and a thousand voices roared back in one huge, inarticulate bellow of bloodlust. The club's owner, Sake Chiba, grinned like a ghoul. He was dressed in a glittering green suit with pinned-back collars and a pair of lizard-skin shoes that cost more than most soldiers made in a month. Hogarth Fix watched him from the competitor benches, shouting when the others shouted, screaming when they screamed.
"Who wants to see blood on this deck?" growled Chiba, pointing a stiff finger at the metal floor on which he stood.
The pentangle was not padded or sprung. There were no mats. Only unforgiving steel and paint. All of the colors were bright whites and yellows, so that blood would stand out. There was always blood. Most of it was red. Some of it was human. All of it was spilled for pay. Fix sat at the end of the second row of fighters. He wasn't on tonight's card, and with any luck, wouldn't ever have to step into the pentangle. He was a good fighter, maybe as good as most of the men and women here, but men and women weren't the only things he might have to fight. In the Special Forces, they taught you how to win fights by any means necessary, including a hell of a lot of ruthless, no-compromise hand-to-hand. But they usually sent their operators in, loaded down with guns, knives, and explosives, and wrapped in body armor. Chiba wasn't about that. Fighters wore spandex shorts. The women were allowed a sports bra. No cups, no pads. Tape on the hands, but no bite shields or Kevlar 4L. No spider silk limb pads, none of that. Meat and muscle, blood and bone, and the advantages of knowledge and experience. Against monsters. Last night, the title match featured a big Serbian kid who had served 5 tours with the Interglobal Soviet People's Army, and who had a win record in mixed martial arts matches on Earth of 28-1. Moose of a guy. Fix wouldn't have wanted to meet him in a dark alley with anything short of a shoulder-mounted rocket launcher. The Serbian went in as the odds-on favorite, and if he had thrown down against any of the other guys on this bench, he might have walked out. Instead, they shoveled him into a body bag, the parts of him that the tiger hadn't eaten. If you could call that cocksucker a tiger, transgenics is a funny thing. The body was tiger, but the jaws hinged open like a snake, and the neurotoxin sacs in his mouth were from a pufferfish. The serve lasted longer than anyone would have guessed once Chiba trotted the beast out of its cage. 87 seconds. Everyone in the first 6 rows were speckled red. That was how this worked. If the Serbian had beaten the tiger, or even lasted the full 3 minutes, he'd have pocketed enough cash to buy a farm on one of the terraformed moons. A good-sized farm, too. Maybe grow hashish for the crews of the long-range haulers. Instead, the cleanup crew had collected enough of him for burial purposes, and his participation fee, a few thousand, went to his mother back on Earth. Fix wasn't sure what kind of message went with it. Probably airlock failure. That was always popular. Sake Chiba was still whipping the crowd up for the next bout. He was a big man himself, a former sumo wrestler from New Osaka, who'd retired while he was still on top and invested half his money in promotion and the rest in technology stocks. He was one of the new class of trillionaires who seemed unable to stop making money. His latest enterprise, Game World, was technically off the books, but people knew about it, whispered about it, bragged about having been there. Chiba was why Hogarth Fix was here. Not the fights, not the mutant monsters, not this fucking crowd of bloodthirsty privileged dickheads who spent insane amounts of money to watch illegal matches. Chiba. If you wanted to bet on it, have sex with it, eat it, or kill it, Chiba could set it up. And because Game World was in the Rocks, a part of the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter that had questionable territorial affiliation, he got away with it. That was going to change, Fix promised himself. And when it did, Chiba was going to the mat, and Fix was going to stroll off with enough money to make sure his kids never had to want for anything. Not ever again. Not after this. Fix watched Chiba's eyes as he worked the crowd. The man fed on this. Not on the fun, not on the energy, maybe not even on the money. No, he was like a vampire. He fed on the adoration, and that's what this was. People worshipped him as the celebrity's celebrity.
"Do you want blood?"
demanded Chiba. people, some of whom were as rich as Chiba, were screaming hysterically, pumping their fists in the air, faces flushed red, eyes wild. One of them, the actress from London who was in those movies about the ice dancer on Europa, started the chant.
Blood! Blood! Blood!
The rest of the crowd took it up at once.
Blood! Blood! Blood!
Fix glanced around at his fellow competitors. 18 men, 11 women, one surgical hermaphrodite. Five of them had won several matches here. This wasn't the Roman circus, as one of them had told him during training. Sometimes it was human against human. Sometimes the fighters on this bench won out against the trans-G animals. Helga, a troll-like woman next to him, had broken the neck of an orangutan last Tuesday. She still had bandages over the stitches, but she'd won, and when the bandages came off, she swore to go back onto the floor to paint my name in the blood of anyone or anything they send out of the gate. Take that to the bank, newbie. That's what she'd told him. The animals weren't the only things here that had paid a visit to their local Dr. Frankenstein. Helga's muscle mass had no origin in nature. The metal struts supporting the Mexican wrestler's back sure as hell weren't original packaging. But that wasn't something the game world recruiters told guys like Fix. Not until they'd already signed on. Which meant that half the people on the competitor bleachers were as unenhanced as he was. The Mexican had talked about it with him the other night.
They need someone to die out there, he said philosophically. Because people don't come all the way out here to watch us thumb wrestle. You don't pay these ticket prices to see two knuckle-draggers batter each other to a split decision. Fuck that. You got to have something dead on the floor by the end of the night. Chiba's got a reputation to keep up. But screw it. Who wants to live forever, right?
That was how it was. Fix pretended to smile, faked his war chance, shook his fists, and felt his heart hammering against the inside of his chest. He had been a soldier for a lot of years, and a rough-and-tumble street kid before that. He'd killed with guns and knives and his own hands, and he'd walked off battlefields littered with fallen comrades. But he had never, not in all his life, been this scared. Chapter 2 They didn't call Fix's number that night. Or the next. Or the next.
Don't worry, said Helga. You'll get your shot, sweetie.
Can't wait, he lied.
He was sure he'd told bigger lies than that, but he couldn't remember when. Life on Game World was strange. Long periods of calm and even some luxurious living, interspersed with intense workouts and shocking violence. Every day. This was day 16 for him. Most fighters, he learned, didn't get their first undercard match for a month or two. There was that much competition to be noticed as having fought for Chiba. They called the dormitory the Box of Scorpions, which was a name that everyone seemed to think was stupid and juvenile, but no one could shake. It was mentioned in a lot of the press, and customers could even pay to bunk down with the fighters. A few, only the really tough ones, or the abominably stupid ones, paid to train with the team. Everyone else was scared off by the wording of the personal injury waivers. The fighters could choose to train at any time, never against each other, of course, but Chiba seemed able to tap an endless supply of willing sparring partners. Fix spent a lot of time watching the other fighters train, studying their moves, gauging their skill, calculating how much was natural talent, how much was learned technique, and how much came from actual experience. That was one of his gifts, perhaps his most useful one. He could read people. He'd been able to do it growing up in the slums of Gary, Indiana, fighting for food money, fighting for money to keep his three younger sisters fed and dressed and healthy after their single mother rode a needle into the big black. It served him well, even against better fighters, when a judge suggested he box in a local gym or spend 6 months in juvie. It helped him when another judge suggested that the military might be a better calling than working a prison detail mining precious metals on an asteroid. And it had kept him alive all through his 12 years humping battle rattle around the solar system. It had not, sadly, helped him figure out that his ex-wife had been sleeping with nearly everyone who had a dick, a pulse, and a good credit rating. That blindsided him, as surely as she'd been blindsided by an autonomous drive UPS glider. Life's a quirky bitch like that. On a busy Friday morning, he climbed into the sparring ring with a new training partner. A black guy, with a shaved head and cat's eye implants that were supposed to psych people out. Fix rarely looked at an opponent's eyes. Bad fighters don't know where to look, and good fighters use their eyes to fool you. As Fix and his sparring partner, Owl, began moving around, Fix watched the other guy's body. They moved in a counterclockwise circle, Owl moving forward with a rocking motion, shifting weight between front and back leg with a lot of springy tension. He's either a jumper or a kicker, or both. Owl tried a few experimental jabs to try and provoke a counterpunch from Fix. That was telling. When Owl jabbed, there was nothing behind the blows. They were light and fast, but he wasn't even trying to hit. Not a boxer, Fix decided. A boxer who could kick moved differently than a kicker who could throw a punch. Boxers had pride in their jabs, and there was always something to them. There was often a momentary set of body mass to make sure all of the PSI went down the arm and into the other guy, instead of the way this guy did it. When Fix blocked Owl's jabs, the lack of weight placement caused some of the force to recoil against his own mass, and Owl rocked back each time. Fix filed that away. Sometimes a good boxer will pivot, even on a jab. Not a lot, but just enough and at high speed to make sure there was some authority to even the lightest punch. Couple more jabs and he's going to kick, thought Fix. A low, tight kick to the thighs. Something to keep me from outpacing him. It was inevitable. Owl jabbed, jabbed, faked, jabbed, and then kicked. A Muay Thai shin kick. Very, very fast. Fix evaded it because he saw it coming yesterday, and could have swept the man right there and then. He could also have J-stepped into him, checked the kick on his hip, had done some of what his old coach had called neighborhood work. A series of body blows designed to bruise the rib so bad that breathing would take too much effort. Fighters who lose their wind lose their fights. Owl was good, but he wasn't good enough for Game World. Some of the trainers and staff were wandering around, watching the sparring matches. Out of the corner of his eye, Fix saw Chiba come in, and that split second of inattention earned him a creditable front kick to the gut. Fix rode it backward, letting the kick spend its force as a push, and then he danced sideways and let Owl chase him until Fix caught his breath. Owl seemed to think he was winning the fight because he charged after Fix with a series of mid-height kicks that would have done a lot of damage had any of them landed. Fix worked his way backward and around, not letting the kicks drive him to the edge of the ring, but instead tapping the incoming legs and using the force of his taps to power sideways cuts and jags. The kicks were very fast, and as Owl got more frustrated, the kicks carried more power. Too much. Fast kicks using snap were okay for a flurry, but heavier smashing and thrusting kicks used more of the kicker's body mass to deliver them, and that drained energy. Fast. Owl was sweating heavily, and the match clock said they'd been going for only 2 minutes. Then Owl's frustration overwhelmed his common sense, and he tried to close the deal with a huge, max-power spinning heel kick. Had it connected, it would have knocked out Fix and everyone he was related to. But it was too big a kick for a match like this. Fix could have gone out for a sandwich and a cup of coffee and been back before that spin brought Owl's heel anywhere near his intended target. The problem was, Owl had committed so heavily to it that Fix was going to have to dent him to keep this from getting truly ugly.
Fuck. He stepped in, chin tucked, shoulder hunched, and checked the spin at its source by jamming hard against the thigh. It was where the spin was most vulnerable. And because there was no other way of wrapping this up, he did some neighborhood work. He could see the look of confusion and then understanding in Owl's eyes as the man realized how badly he had underestimated his opponent. Fix was in his late 30s, and his hair was prematurely salt and pepper. Bad posture and scar tissue made him look like someone who'd been living the hard life. He looked older, slower, and smaller than he actually was. Owl went down to knees and palms, choking and gagging and trying to breathe. Fix sighed and stepped back, feeling sorry for the man. When he turned away, he immediately stopped, because Sake Chiba was standing 10 feet behind him. The big sumo wrestler was smoking a fat European cigar and grinning.
"What's your name?"
he asked. Chapter 3. They were in Chiba's office, which was the size of most hotel lobbies, seated on opposite sides of a huge hardwood desk that must have cost a fortune to ship all the way out here, where everything was plastic or metal. One wall was filled with shelves crammed with trophies and awards from Chiba's days as a pro wrestler. The opposite wall was a massive glass aquarium in which transgenically designed mermaids swam. There were harsh laws about human-animal hybridization, but Fix thought that the upper halves of each mermaid was a real adolescent girl. There was a vague look of self-aware horror in the oversized eyes of the swimming creatures. It was appalling. Behind the desk was a wall safe with a massive steel door and a complex locking mechanism set with several kinds of biometric scanners. Fix longed to raid that safe, but there was no chance in the universe that he'd ever even glimpse what was inside. More than he'd ever need in 10 lifetimes. Shit, even if that vault was stacked floor to ceiling with currency, it couldn't be more than a drop of piss to someone like Chiba. The man was worth, according to the financial news, $6.6 trillion. His beer money would pay every bill Fix would ever have and still leave enough to buy Texas. Chiba waved him to a seat and poured them both a good knock of gin over frozen cherries.
"That was a very interesting exhibition," said Chiba as he settled into his own massive chair. "Just a sparring match, sir. Al's got some nice moves. Made me work for it."
Chiba grinned.
"Bullshit. I saw 11 separate times when you could have hurt him and you didn't. I could see that you didn't. Not until he gave you no choice."
Fix sipped his drink, said nothing, waited.
"Why not?" asked Chiba. "Just a sparring match,"
Fix repeated.
"Ah,"
said Chiba, brightening.
"You didn't want to go all out because there were no stakes." "That's part of it, sure. Let me guess the rest. There were other fighters in the room. You didn't want to school them on how you really fight."
Fix nodded.
"That's about it, boss."
Chiba swallowed half his drink and sat crunching a cherry, his eyes studying Fix.
"Your ex-army?"
"Yes. Been out for a while now."
"Special forces, as I understand it."
"Sure."
"Where did you see action?"
"Here and there. Lots been going on around the system. Mostly by the time they sent us in, things had either gone to hell or cooled down. The movies they make glamorize it, but we didn't do anything too crazy."
"Oh? It's my understanding that you were a team leader when Spec Ops breached the prison ship after it had been taken over by the inmates?"
Fix said nothing. The records of that mission were sealed. No one outside of the military high command should be able to read that file. Chiba continued.
"Then there was the Rubio cartel on Mars that got wiped out virtually overnight, and the rescue of the ambassador and her entire staff. A 12-man team goes in and saves the lives of 86 people in a hot zone. 117 hostiles dead. Shall I go on?
Guess you don't have to. The big man nodded.
And now, you're here.
Now I'm here.
And why is that, Mr. Fix?
If you know everything about me, then you already know why I'm here.
Fair enough,
conceded Chiba.
You have 3 kids. Your wife is dead and you're sinking in debt. Your youngest, is her name Daisy?
Daisy, said Fix hoarsely.
Daisy, she has cancer. Your health coverage doesn't begin to stretch far enough to cover the medical bills. Not if you can get her into the new treatment program in Stockholm. You could never hope to beg, borrow, or steal that much money.
Fix said nothing.
So, while I can't understand what might have made you look in my direction, I am known as a generous employer and fight purses will stretch far enough to provide for your family. Why risk it? You can't earn enough money if you're dead.
Actually, said Fix, I can.
Life insurance policy?
Yeah, with an off-world danger clause. The way I figure it, either I earn enough and bring the cash home, or I die trying, and my estate planner and lawyer make sure Daisy and the other kids are taken care of. As long as I fight, I can't really lose.
You're not afraid of dying?
Fix was prepared to lie, because he lied a lot. He didn't give Chiba a lie in answer to that question.
Of course I am. But I'm a lot more afraid of failing my kids.
Chiba finished his drink and poured another. Then he sat back and studied Fix for a long, quiet time. A slow smile formed on his face.
I'm not sure I can remember the last time I was impressed by personal integrity.
Thanks.
But I like you. I like the moves I saw downstairs. I like the fire I see in your eyes. And I even like the fear I see there. Ruthless fighters are a dime a dozen. They're entertaining in the short term, but boring overall. You, on the other hand, might be something else. You're not fighting because you hate everyone or because you're dead inside. No, you're fighting for love. Not sure I've ever seen that before. Certainly not on Game World.
Fix sipped his drink. His pulse had suddenly jumped.
I want to offer you a fight,
said Chiba.
Okay.
Fix said neutrally.
Kind of why I'm here, though, isn't it?
I'm not talking about a brawl with one of the lunkheads in the box of scorpions. No. I have a special card coming up, and I've been looking for exactly the right fighter for it.
Why is that me?
Because I like what I saw today, and I like what I've seen in your military record. You are that rare kind of counterfighter. It is a kind of scientist of combat. It's there in the after-action reports from your spec ops missions, and it was evident in the way you fought Owl. You analyze, you deconstruct and assess, and then you adjust your own fighting style accordingly. That's an old samurai skill, and it's very much the way I used to fight. It's why I won so many times. It's why I'm good in business, because I study my opponents and can anticipate what they will do, how they'll move, when they'll act.
Fix studied Chiba over the rim of his glass as he took a micro-sip.
If you're talking about asking me to fight a grizzly or some shit, then I don't see that as a real career opportunity for me. My trip and fall out of an airlock and the insurance company will still pay off to my kids. I don't need to be humiliated in some stunt match.
Stunt match?
echoed Chiba, mildly miffed. Then he shrugged.
Sure, okay. You got me on that.
The rubes love them, though.
I'm not a rube. No.
Agreed Chiba.
But that's really not the kind of fight I have in mind. No bears, no tigers, no growth-enhanced centipedes. And I don't think I want to waste you on mouth-breathers like Helga or the other idiots you've been bunking with.
Who's that leave?
Not who,
said Chiba, beaming at him.
It's really more of a... what?
Chapter 4
What in the hell is that thing?
Chiba and Fix stood on a catwalk above the lighted rim of a containment tank. The tank was circular and 30 feet deep, with smooth walls and a floor covered with straw and piles of dark green matter that stank like shit. Fix realized it probably was shit, despite the color. There were bones and pieces of torn meat scattered around the pit. No bed. No furniture. A single figure stood in the center of the pit, staring up at them.
I have no idea,
said Chiba happily.
How can you not know? You made it, didn't you? Or your pet scientists?
Chiba shook his head.
No, I told you. This isn't one of my genetic toys. Quite frankly, none of us know what this thing is. And isn't that wonderful? Is it human?
Stammered Fix. Chiba pointed down at the creature.
Human? That? You tell me.
The thing was vaguely manlike, in that it had two arms and two legs, a muscular torso, a head, and two eyes. Beyond that, any resemblance to humanity faltered and died. It stood a little over 6 feet tall, and its limbs were packed with dense, corded muscle. It had skin as pale and mottled as a mushroom. The hands were hideous, with long, clawed fingers ending in wicked claws. Fix couldn't see its face because it wore a helmet of strange design, but braided hair hung like dreadlocks down to its shoulders. The only clothing it wore was a pair of trunks made from dark brown leather and some kind of netting that covered its limbs and massive chest. Some of the netting was torn, Fix could see, and there were green lines, like scars, crisscrossing its body, and from a few of these thin lines, a more luminous green oozed. Chiba noticed him looking at that, and said,
Blood. My science guys are having orgasms trying to figure out its chemistry. It's nothing they've ever seen, which makes them all very, very happy. They're badgering me about whether they'll be able to publish, which, of course, they won't.
He grinned.
Possession of an alien life form is illegal, even way out here in the rocks. It's one of the few things all governments agree on.
Alien?
It was discovered in the wreckage of a crashed ship on the dwarf planet Ceres, said Chiba. They're terraforming Ceres, you know, doing a nice job of it, too. They found a lot of wonderful mineral deposits and a lot of water ice. More than the surveyors said to expect. But they never expected to find anything as remarkable as this.
This is incredible. God, how come everyone doesn't know about this? This changes... shit, it changes everything.
Sure, I could sell it to a government or a museum and make a quick billion. But let's be real. That is very small change compared to what I can make with this thing in my stable of fighters.
Fix shook his head.
If you put this thing on a title card, everyone's going to know about it.
Chiba snorted.
Oh, I have that covered. We can bounce a video signal out to the rim, jog it around a bit, and then send it back as if it comes from somewhere outside of anyone's territory. Our signal boosters are on military-grade stealth satellite pods with EMP and explosive failsafes. Trust me, Mr. Fix. I've been doing this for a long time.
Fix nodded. Someone as rich as Chiba had more than technology on his side. He could afford to bribe, threaten, or own key people in the agencies that were supposed to regulate or arrest people like him. They stared down into the pit.
My people tell me that you will need at least $1 million to pay for your daughter's treatment over the next few years. And you'll need half of that to settle debts and care for your other kids. Round it up for inflation, and you need $2 million. Does that sound fair?
Fix cleared his throat.
Yeah. If you can last 3 minutes with our friend down there, I will pay you $9 million.
Fix wheeled around.
What? That is $3 million per minute. But here's the kicker, my friend. I want you both alive at the end. Hurt it, break it, I don't care. But I need it alive, because my molecular biologists have a lot of fun things planned with its DNA. What kind of fighter is it? I mean, does it have special skills? It has training, said Chiba. It moves like a warrior. It's incredibly strong and fast. It has excellent reflexes. And it is definitely a killer. Meaning, even badly injured and starving, it managed to kill 7 members of the crew of 11 on the salvage ship that found it. And since I acquired it, I've done a few experiments. With people? Not at first. Animals. A cougar, a mountain gorilla like that. People came later. Came and went. Our friend down there seems to enjoy extreme combat. It's one of his most endearing qualities. Has anyone come close to beating it?
Chiba shrugged.
In exosuits, with military-grade shock rods, yes. Otherwise, well, we're on the wrong side of the learning curve with him. His injuries are mostly healed, except for a few recent scrapes from our ongoing tests. It's worth $9 million to me to put him in a ring with a fighter with your skill set. Someone who can use his brains as well as his fists. $9 million is nothing to me, but it's everything to your family, Mr. Fix. And that makes this a fair contract. You are ready to throw your life away against transgenic animals or bio-enhanced fighters. This is single combat of the most basic kind. No weapons. No armor. Only whatever natural gifts you both bring into the pentangle. This will be the most important fight in the history of, well, fighting. This will be history. And win or lose, you're going to be the most famous warrior in the solar system. So, do we have a deal?
The creature in the pit raised its head as if it could understand Chiba's words. The lenses on the helmet prevented Fix from seeing its eyes, but he knew if he could, there would be nothing there but hatred. He knew that his own eyes were probably filled with different emotions. Need. Desperation. And fear.
Yeah. He murmured. Yeah. I'm in.
Chapter 5. The prep work for the event took weeks. During that time, Chiba provided Fix with the best trainers, the best sports medicine people, the best food, and every luxury Fix might want. Fix turned down the prostitutes and the AI sex bots. He trained and trained and recorded long videos for each of his kids to try and tell them the things a father would. He repeatedly requested the chance to view any video files of the tests conducted with the creature that involved combat, whether against humans or animals. Chiba refused on the grounds that it would pollute the integrity of the event. With each day, Fix felt his tension growing. He slept badly and had to eat antacids by the handful to keep from throwing up his guts. The doctors gave him shots of vitamins, and they monitored his health, often offering sleeping pills, dream gas, or medical sex therapy, but Fix bulled through without any of that. This was going to be tough enough without his brain being fogged. After a while, though, he forced himself to try and get more sleep, to meditate, to eat a saner diet of protein-rich foods. The weeks melted down to days, and then hours. On the morning of the bout, Hogarth Fix woke from a terrible dream of running through a jungle being hunted by something that he could not see. Something that filled the air with flashes of red that tore through flesh and bone, and stone and trees. He ran past the bodies of every soldier he had ever known, and although many had died on worlds or moons far away from Game World, their bodies were all in the dream, freshly killed, slaughtered, skinned, hung up like deer carcasses after a hunt. The invisible thing pursued him all the way into a trap. A cave filled with the skulls and spines of all of those dead. A mountain of them. Fix fell to his knees and looked around at the walls, seeing trophies hung there. The skulls of the great hunting cats, cave bears, elephants, alligators, and more, dinosaurs and other creatures Fix had only ever seen in museums. All dead. All conquered. He sank to his knees. A sound made him turn, and behind him, in the cave's mouth, a massive form was appearing out of nowhere. At first, there was only a shimmer, and then it appeared. Monstrously tall, massively built, heavily armored. Dreadlocks whipped back and forth as the creature looked around its trophy room. It was much bigger than the thing in the pit, impossibly tall. It raised one arm, fist closed, and a set of three wicked metal blades sprang from sheaths built into the gauntlets. There were smears of fresh blood on those blades. Fix looked down at his own stomach and saw that his shirt and flesh were torn. His guts slid out and flopped wetly to the ground between his knees. Fix screamed himself awake. In a happy, chirpy voice, the AI system said,
"Good morning, Hogarth. It's fight day. Would you like scrambled eggs and coffee?"
Chapter 6 Fight Day. There had been a lot of matches at Game World since Fix agreed to this fight. Humans against humans. Humans against transgenic animals. Teams against teams. Fix had watched them all, trying to prepare his mind for this. As if that was even possible. He was going to fight an alien. Yeah, history. Shit. He stood in a shower hot enough to boil a lobster. He lost it in there, too, weeping and pounding his fist on the wall. Chiba called him a warrior. Sure, Fix had known a lot of them. Only the fools went into battle without fear, and they were usually the first ones to fall. Most good soldiers were like him. Professional, yes. Capable, to be sure. But human. They hid their fear, because fear is both personal and contagious. They carved religious symbols into their gear. They wore religious medals or good luck charms. They wrote out death letters. Some took pictures of their loved ones with them. Others refused to even name their wives or husbands or children for fear it would jinx them. Some took confession, and others let hot showers wash their tears away in hopes that it cleansed them of excess fear. Then they got ready for war. With Hogarth Fix, the ritual was all about being quiet. He toweled off and dressed in fighting trunks. He said nothing at all to the corner man who wrapped the tapes around his hands. Before the match, he sat on a stool in the locker room, not praying, not thinking, just letting a silence fill him inside. He meditated, drifting right below the surface of wakefulness while his preconceptions dropped like pebbles to the bottom of his pool of awareness. When he heard the game bell, Fix stood and looked into the mirror, into the eyes of the scarred and ugly man who stared back at him. Into dead eyes that told him nothing and would betray nothing to his opponent. There was no hate in those eyes, no judgment, no anger. There was nothing, not even a mirror for the enemy to see his own strengths and weaknesses. He stood up, turned, and walked out.